The Adventures of Indiana Jim, episode number 17, for February 14th, 2009.
And now, coming to you not exactly live from
the Cliffs of Insanity,
a man who needs no introduction, that international man of geekery, that intrepid arch-geekologist, Indiana Jim.
Don't tell me you've never heard of me.
I'll explain, and I'll use small words so that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
Let me put it this way. Have you ever heard of Plato, Aristotle, Socrates?
Yes.
Morons.
You, boy, are arrogant, hot-tempered, entirely too bold.
I like that. Reminds me of me.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, grace. Stupidity.
I have entertained in all the courts of Europe and speak a ready wit in their every tongue.
I told you I was famous.
Indiana Jim, Indiana Jim. This is London calling. Come in, please.
Well, well, well. Just how is everybody doing? Welcome back to Adventures of Indiana Jim number 17. In today's adventure, the first half of my interview with Scott Sigler. The best interview I think I've ever heard. And it has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with my guest. So, you're a congressman. And you're in a hearing. You're up in front of everybody. And what you choose to say when you open your statement is you have a jar of peanut butter and you say, would you like to come up here and open this jar and eat some of this peanut butter? Now, does this not illustrate just what a circus Washington, D.C. has become? That really stuck out with me. Number one, the recall of peanut butter was in, what was it, crackers or something? And then it was in like a meal pack, a relief meal pack, which, you know, that's another thing. You're sending out relief supplies to people, and the peanut butter is poisoned. I mean, that's just wrong. And not only that, the jar of peanut butter never had anything to do with the peanut butter recall, and yet this guy chooses to say, hey, would you like to come up here and eat this peanut butter? Huh? Would you? I mean, really? Come on. I mean, can't we find better ways, like, I don't know, using facts and figures to have a hearing on things? Don't get me started. You really don't want me to. In fact, if you've been following me on Twitter, you can tell I'm a little bit perturbed by the way things are going. And, you know, I think anybody should. If Bush and the Republicans had done that to the Democrats, that still would have been unfair. And I'm just saying, you know, there needs to be debate on major, major issues. And that's really all I'm going to say about that. So what have I been doing lately? Well, I actually have stuff that I've been doing. And I'm making more of a concerted effort to actually write down what I'm doing and talk about it on the podcast. And if you hear me drop out every so often, it's because I'm coughing. Yeah, coughing is exciting. I choose not to do it on the podcast. So I'm waiting for live tweets here for Indiana, the Adventures of Indiana Jim, but I think people are watching television. I understand there were a few shows on tonight, Friday night, the 13th of February. Well, I've been listening. I listened to about half, three quarters of the Daily Source Code, Adam Curry. Kind of an entertaining show. Interesting how, you know, he does the music thing and the news thing, which is something I've thought about doing a long time ago. But I mean, it's kind of what Adam Curry does is what I envisioned doing when I was doing those fake radio shows with my cousin. So it's interesting. He's kind of a conspiracy theorist a little bit, which is okay. I mean, you know, he's an entertaining bloke. He's not too far off the reservation. I had made the joke that Adam Curry was the Art Bell of podcasting, but Art Bell's way off the deep end compared to Adam. Another podcast I have discovered is the podcast Answer Man, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Geek Brief TV, I've finally gotten on board with. I really like that show. It's short. It's quality tech news and kind of, you know, keeps you up to date on. In fact, I saw their most recent episode. I forget what it was about. I can't remember the name of it. And I would open up my iTunes, but it would bog down my processor, so I'm not going to even look. But what it was, a home automation thing. It was like the Harmony remotes, you know. You can plug your TV and your entertainment center and your microwave and your duck pond all into this remote. But it was all connected through Apple, and basically you could use your iPhone as to control everything in your house, from media to HVAC systems to lights to blinds to everything. And this is like Jetsons stuff, okay? This is interesting to see this come about, you know. And I was listening to Glenn Beck recently, and he was talking about how things, you know, most modern technology starts with the uber rich. And there's a live tweet from Bwasink. He says, I don't know how to pronounce it, Ben Wasink. There we go. Hey, Jim, can't wait for your sequel to Starkeeper. Can you tell us one of the new characters? Yes, I can. And that one is, let me just write this, let me make sure I get his name right, because last time I spelled it dyslexically. Yes, Talon Card. That's right, you may have heard this already. Talon Card will be in Starkeeper 2, so that should be very exciting and very fun. So what was I talking about? This automation system. Anyway, he was talking about, you know, the cell phones back in the old days were these huge mammoth things that you see on television, and to have one was amazing, and the big giant cell phone goes in one hand and the battery goes in the other hand, you know? And, you know, now everybody has cell phones. And so it was kind of this reduction of technology cost sort of thing. So I was thinking, you know, very, very rich people used to have these, and now they're still really expensive, but you don't have to be, you know, in the richest 1% or whatever the term is for very wealthy people. Next, Geek Brief Radio. Was it Geek Brief Radio? It was whatever the audio companion to the video podcast is. It's a weekly show. It was interesting, and it's short. You know, that's the thing, is Callie Lewis and the Geek Brief gang, which is her and her husband, and I don't know who else, really, I just got done watching their Ustream show, Callie Live, and it was rather short. You know, they don't go on and on and on and on, and I subscribe to some of these podcasts that just go on and on and on. The Geeks On podcast, and they, you know, they struggle with consistency, but you know, an hour and a half, it's crazy. You know, and I push, you know, 45 minutes, 50 minutes sometimes, but I've really tried to get it back under an hour and keep it there. Let's see what else I've been listening to. Those are kind of the big ones. Trying to think. Well, I just reminded myself I forgot to listen to the Nocturnal Epilogue. Anyway, Battlestar Galactica. Oh, man. I didn't get to watch the show tonight's episode yet, but I will get to it hopefully after this. But it's a lot of fun. And so I'm going to go on to the podcast Answer Man, because this brings up another topic. Basically, podcast Answer Man is sort of a business in the business of podcasting. He produces a lot of podcasts, gets paid to do it. Gets paid for consultant work. So it was basically about being in the digital media business. He was interviewing Michael W. Gohagan. Sorry about the cough there. Michael W. Gohagan is famous for the Podcasting is Dead presentation. And he really never anywhere said podcasting is dead. What happened was he had a couple PowerPoint slides that said podcasting was dead. And if you haven't heard all of this, I'll provide links in the show notes, hopefully on Saturday or Sunday. But interviewing Michael Gohagan, who was basically asking the question, are you defined by your RSS feed? Are you defined by only the content that you put out on your feed? And, you know, we were in a phase where, you know, back in the old days before the RSS feed, where you had to go to somebody's website and download their stuff. And there wasn't a lot out there, but, excuse me, I'm reminded of the Star Wars audio dramas back in 2002, you know, where you had to actually go to the website and download the zip file and do all that. And so we sort of got into this thing where if you don't have an RSS feed, you're providing a disservice to your audience. But what Michael Gohagan was talking about was expanding your core concept beyond podcasting. Deliverable media by RSS or website visits. Why would you define yourself primarily as a podcaster? Because his view was that you're limiting yourself if all you do is say, I'm a podcaster, I'm a podcaster, I'm a podcaster. And he, of course, said things like digital media entrepreneur and some of this really kind of, highfalutin sort of stuff. And I kind of think the term podcaster really is sort of, it's more humble, really. I mean, I'm a podcaster. But of course I am more than a podcaster. I'm a podcaster and I'm a blogger and I'm an audio drama producer and I'm sort of establishing more things in my at my website for people to do. So, you know, I'm going to be an author, hopefully. Cross your fingers. but basically the reason I'm doing this is because of the official Show Observer. My official Show Observer, he doesn't know he's the official Show Observer, but he does now because he's listening, basically was getting me to do more blog posts because we would chat about stuff and I'd be pretty passionate and wordy, and he'd be like, dude, you need to write that blog post. And of course I'd say something like, yeah, whatever, and, you know, okay, and then we go on about our business, and eventually got to the point where I'm like, I really do need to write this stuff down. And so I've had a few blog posts come out of that. One of those, now, I'm breathing heavy because I paused it, ran down the stairs, got something to drink, and came back. And so my breath is catching up to me. I'm really out of shape, you know that? So one of those was the big blog post I did on the Amazon rush. You know, is the Amazon rush dead? And of course, I received a multitude of responses that said, no, it's not. And got a little more information and did a rebuttal to my own to my own article. And so it was kind of a similar situation for Michael Gohagan, but his point really boiled down to podcasting is not the industry. Podcasting is a tool. If we're talking about monetization, for me, none of the podcasts I listen to make money for the podcast. Aside from now, Podcast Answer Man. You take T. Morris. He's an author. He teaches kind of production classes. You know, his income is either the freelance work or writing. Scott Sigler, he's an author. Tracy and Laura Hickman, authors. The shows I listen to are designed either to promote work in another medium or it's just a hobby. So, you know, I discovered Podcast Answer Man. I really like what I hear. He makes the bulk of his money as a consultant and producer, and I think that the financial gain there probably exceeds what he earns with his premium content that he has. And I really like his show. I can't wait to hear more from him. Now, episode 91, he took part in a roundtable discussion with Joe Jaffe of the Jaffe Juice podcast, and there was Adam Curry, Mignon Fogarty, Grammar Girl, Cliff Ravenscraft of Podcast Answer Man, and others. One of the most interesting parts of this was when Adam Curry, he defined the business model of Mevio, which, you know, Mevio, but he mentioned transactions rather than traditional advertising. And I see this with Geek Brief TV. In fact, I used one of Geek Brief TV's promo codes when I set up 49ersfancast.com. Ding! Oh, wait. I can't do the ding right now. What I have to do, I have to go to my Jazzler show here. And I'm going to find my sound effect. Yeah, here we go. So I used Geek Brief TV's promo code when I set up 49ersfancast.com. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my bell right there. So when I say things like, I don't know, IndianaGym.net. Yeah, forget the bell, baby. We got the whip crack right there. Yes! So that's going to be our sound effect going forward here. But you see talk radio going to this transaction thing where you log on to GoDaddy or ProFlowers or any number of sites and enter a code to get a certain amount off your transaction with that company. It's not only an instantly measurable thing, but the listener automatically receives a benefit just for listening. I think, Adam Curry said, it's really probably the model to define what happens with podcasting going forward, because generic sponsorship, generic advertisements, it's not, there's not an immediate benefit, number one, to the listener, and number two, to the advertiser, because the advertiser doesn't necessarily know if they're generating any business. I thought it was interesting. You know, when you make a generic ad buy, you basically say, come to our website or buy our product. It doesn't have the incentive for the customer to visit that website unless they really, really want the product, you know. So that's it pretty much for that. We'll go ahead and get to that Scott Sigler interview, the first half, right after a few messages here.
Immortality, longevity, an endless lifespan. What would you do to become immortal?
My name is McAllen Orsel. I'm a genetic scientist in New York. I'm caught in a secret war between two powerful groups of immortals. I've been told that I am a messiah to a group of people I barely know. I'm forced on a quest around the globe to fulfill a destiny I never chose. If only I can stay alive.
From Krzysztof Laputka comes the Leviathan Chronicles, an audio adventure like you've never heard before.
What is Leviathan?
We have been among you for almost a millennia.
What? Immortal?
They can't know about Leviathan.
Blow those charges.
No!
Get down!
Why have you brought me here?
You are here because we need your help.
She was never trained for this.
She was bred for it, Anton.
But she doesn't know that.
You'll need to find me, McAllen.
To discover the Leviathan Chronicles and get the next dimension in podcasting, go to www.leviathanchronicles.com.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Haidt. And I am a compulsive short story writer. I used to write all the time and just stick my stories in a drawer. I didn't have any place to go with them. And then I found Great Heights. Great Heights is a wonderful place. You go every week on Monday and they post a new prompt. And on Tuesday of the following week, you turn in your story. And that's it. Well, not really it. Then they post it and podcast it. And it's wonderful. I feel so much better. Hi, Jeffrey Hyde here. Come join myself and the many others who have found relief for compulsive short story writing at Great Heights. That's Great Heights, HITES.blogspot.com, where 100-word stories are only the beginning.
I've got to learn to turn Twitter off when I'm doing the promos, because it's like ding right in the middle of it, or better yet, yeah, that. You know, I was just thinking, Leviathan Chronicles sounds really cool. I need to go check that out. I you know, kind of sounds bad. I'm playing the promo and I haven't checked it out, but, you know, I solicited a bunch of promos and sort of just stuck them in here and decided out of the blue to play that one. And I'm definitely going to go check that out. That sounds pretty cool. It sounds almost like a Scott Sigler space opera-ish. Well, I can't say space opera because it just it reminded me of something I have done and will go back to eventually. Sort of a space opera with genetics, and I don't know if it's going to be any good, but, you know, it interests me. But Great Heights, Jeff, seriously, I didn't realize that it was like that. I just thought it was, you know, his stuff, but there's writing prompts? Huh, I might have to try that out, maybe as a exercise, or maybe I'll read some for them. But anyway, without any further ado, I give you the man, the myth, the legend, Scott Sigler. All right, I want to welcome now to the Adventures of Indiana Jim, the author of Earthcore, Ancestor, The Rookie, Nocturnal, Infected, and Contagious, Scott Sigler.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for being here.
No, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
First question I want to ask you, how's the Evil Queen?
Much better. We just had our scan results today, and it looks like she's good for another 6 months, 20,000 miles. We go back in 6 months, get another scan, but she had thyroid cancer, and they pulled that out of there, and then they loaded her up with radioactive iodine, which seemed to have killed what was remaining, so it's looking good.
That's really good to hear.
Thank you.
I know someone, I have a friend who has thyroid cancer, and it went rather smoothly with her, too. So.
Yeah.
So many prayers and good wishes for the Evil Queen's recovery. So you've done something a lot of us honestly thought would take longer for one of the podcast authors, but you made the New York Times bestseller list with Contagious, so congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
How has life changed for you since that happened?
Well, it hasn't changed that much. I really thought we were going to get it with Infected, mm-hmm. and we had the numbers to get it with Infected.
Right.
Because we outsold several of the books that were on the extended list. And it's important for your listeners to understand, too. We made the list, and we get that credit, and that's great. But that's the extended list, so it goes all the way to 35.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different than being, like, you know, in the top 10. There's an exponential difference in the amount of copies sold. But we had enough with Infected. They didn't give it to us. And then we came out with Contagious, and they did. So life hasn't changed all that much. I got to get ramped up for the next book pretty much, and that's the focus. Now that the wife's in better shape, that's the focus. Right now, I'm trying to figure out with the publisher what the next book will be.
Oh, okay.
I even ran a poll over at scottsigler.com, which, at least at the time we're recording this, is still up where fans can vote between Ancestor, a remake of Ancestor, which is kind of a, I guess, a classic in the patio book community at this point. And then I put it out in print, too, and that did really well as a trade paperback, an indie mm-hmm. trade paperback.
Right.
Crown bought the rights to that, so they can put that one out. They could put out Pandemic, which is the third book in the Infected Contagious trilogy. Or they can opt for Nocturnal, which is a podcast novel I just got finished with. So the fans are over there voting on it right now. Right now, everything is pointing towards putting out Ancestor, probably in December of 2009.
Cool. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, so that'll be rewritten and be out in hardcover, and it'll be up on the shelf with all the other hardcovers, so it'll be kind of cool.
Well, I'm excited for you. This is just really awesome. So the reason I asked you to come on, I wanted to address some questions that had arisen from the post I made that I wrote on IndianaJim.net, ding, about what to do with your novel now that it's written. So before I get to the really big question, I have a few things to lead up to it. One thing I forgot to actually include in there was that you started out going the traditional route. You actually had a deal on the table, and the rug was pulled out from underneath you. Was that Earthcore?
Yeah, that was with Earthcore, mm-hmm. and I spent... many years pinging agents, pinging publishers, and finally was able to connive a deal with AOL Time Warner for Earthcore.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, it was due out in May of 2002, and the 9/11 recession hit, and AOL Time Warner just said, you know what, everything that's not profitable, we're just cutting it. They cut the imprint. Earthcore was completely dead. So I was cut out at the knees right there.
Wow, so you've really been on the high. You're on the highs now, and you've been on the lows.
It's been a roller coaster, man. Because, like, you know, you start out on the bottom trying to figure out the industry, and I literally spent every vacation day for 5 years going to different conventions and trying to meet people in the industry and figure out what I need to do and make the right contacts. Turn that into the book deal with AOL Time Warner. So now then you're up on high. It was supposed to be in every bookstore in the country in paperback. And then AOL Time Warner collapsed, or that deal collapses and went all the way back to less than zero because I couldn't even get the rights to Earthcore back. It took me 3 years just to get the rights back to the book in order to try and take it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And now back on high again. So there you go.
So, when you were writing Earthcore, were you writing a lot of this other stuff too, or was it kind of the one book at a time?
No, the first book was Infected. And it was just writing a book to see if I could write a book, and it was really bad. And then I finished with that, and I put it away, and I wrote Earthcore. Then I finished Earthcore and thought I was pretty badass, and then pulled out Infected again. I was like, oh my goodness, this I'm not very good at this. And I had put it away, which is, you know, part of my advice to new people is like, I put it away for 6 months. When I pulled it out again, thinking I was the hotness, I read it, and I'm like, I'm just awful. And being able to see what's actually on the page and not knowing what I was trying to say, but what I actually said was huge.
Yeah.
So then I wrote Infected, then I wrote Ancestor, then I rewrote Infected, and it's just been going on. So it's been nonstop writing for 15 years.
Wow. Okay, so you spent all this time, your blood, sweat, and tears, you put in this book, and the deal falls out. So you have this great story you want to tell, and everybody kind of knows what happened next about your success with Earthcore. What I'm interested in first is, were you with Podshow with Earthcore, or did that happen later with The Rookie?
I did Earthcore all on my own, then I did Ancestor all on my own, and then I joined Podshow with literally like one episode left of Ancestor. So all the stuff we did with Ancestor and Earthcore was all me and my cronies out there in the space. And then I was with Podshow, who is now Mevio, for Infected and for The Rookie.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know how much, if any, at all, that Podshow contributed to your massive audience numbers, but
not a lot. I mean, they were a rock solid platform for hosting for sure, and they went out and got me advertising, which was great. Right. Not so much anymore, but they've changed their business model. It's a little bit different now. But they were really solid in those categories, and they were a good community and good people to work with, but. For the most part, all of that promo for Earthcore and Ancestor, that was all me. And by the time the Earthcore book came out, or the Ancestor book came out, you know, I was back to, I didn't really get that level of support from Podshow that we'd planned a bunch of things together and none of them really happened. And I kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit, but, I'm still working with them, still taking advertising from them. And even though everybody there has changed over more than a few times, there's still a lot of positives to that company, to work with them.
Right. Okay. So we know how successful you were then, and that's just pretty awesome that you kind of built that yourself. And the number that gets thrown out there is 30,000 listeners or something. That's kind of a big blurry number. Was this like an average per episode or per month, or how was that defined?
That was defined basically by Ancestor, probably about a year to a year and a half after Ancestor was done, and we started to look at the numbers because we were coming out for print. And we just were going back and looking at the stats for the actual episodes. Okay. And that was one of the reasons I moved my files from Mevio over to Libsyn is Mevio tracks their stats a little bit differently. They track download requests, which means every time somebody's iTunes goes out and pings the feed to see if there's a new episode, that counts as a hit, the way Mevio tracks things. So if my iTunes is set to update every 15 minutes, you know, that's going to be 24 times 15. That's all the hits that are coming from one person every day. So the numbers from the Mevio numbers can skew to the obscene amounts and incredibly, incredibly quickly. But it wasn't giving me an accurate count. So on Libsyn, they try and do a better job of parsing unique IPs, so that each person who gets the file is only tracked once.
Right.
And then I also use feedburner.com, which tracks unique IP hits within a 24-hour period. So I use a couple of different metrics to try and gauge what the audience is. But the 30,000, that's more, you know, down the road, like a year after the book is out, because a lot of people come in after the fact. Right. A lot of people wait for the whole book to be done. The general rule now is I usually have like about 10,000 downloads on Libsyn within I'd say 48 hours of posting an episode, and then the rest filter in throughout the course of the year.
That's amazing when I compare that to, you know, for 2 days I get maybe 60. That's phenomenal. So what was your goal when you brought out Ancestor Imprint and you had the Amazon Rush? What was your specific goal with that?
My goal was to hit number one overall on Amazon. My goal was to really, really shove it down the throats of big publishing, to be like, you know, it was a combination. It's a combination of the punk rock screw you. And then the other side going like, hey, look, dude, I'm, you know, my stuff will sell. I can prove my stuff will sell. What's wrong with you? Why aren't you signing me so that we can get in bed together and make a bunch of people entertained? So it was that was pretty much a two prong. And I thought there's no better way to do that than to hit number one overall on Amazon, which, you know, as I've said a million times in different interviews, that's not Stephen King numbers. That's not Anne Rice numbers. It's not Stephanie Meyer's numbers, not even in the same ballpark. But showing that you can do that with a fiction novel, mm-hmm. And not having any distribution or any advertising or any media coverage,
right.
that's a big friggin' deal if you can pull that off. And that's what happened. We wound up hitting number two overall in fiction behind a Harry Potter book. And we were number one in sci-fi and number one in horror. And that just turned out to be the right timing, because I had a new agent at that time who had Infected on about 10 different desks in New York of people who hadn't seen it before. And about seven of them were considering making an offer. They had liked it. And then the Ancestor thing hit, and it went nutso from there.
Okay. This kind of leads me up to the big question that I mentioned in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Now, you and Hutch have these huge audiences, and Merle Lafferty as well, but you and Hutch are the first two to land deals with major houses for your books. I know your answer to my blog post was podcast the book. And here's a direct quote from what you said. Podcasting is the rocket that brings you audience, builds your brand, and gives you something to show the big publishers that you deserve their attention. And yes, you can sell more books than 95% of the talent, quote unquote, that they have already published. Now, the thing that needles at me, though, is you and Hutch, for lack of a better term, have a bigger rocket than, say, the rest of the podcast authors. So what is it for you and Hutchins, what is it that separates you guys from other podcast novelists that, you know, you look at their subscriber numbers and let's just take T, just pull him out of the hat. I mean, your books are probably more accessible, more mainstream probably than Moravia is.
Mm-hmm.
But you compare, his subscribers are in the, you know, 700 range, and your subscribers are just these astronomical numbers. So what is it? Is it the genre? Is it the violence that appeals to the visceral in people? Or is it simply you guys doing the voices yourself? How do you build such an enormous rocket?
I think it pretty much boils down to three elements, which is you got to have a good content, which most of the people out there doing this for a while have. You've got to be consistent for a period of about 3 years for things to start happening, right? And then you've got to be a tireless promoter. And I know that T has had a lot of things pop up in his life that have taken him out of the consistency angle of things.
Okay.
And he's also, you know, he's an entrepreneur. He's a contractor. He's been out hustling to bring in, you know, real money now for his family. Those things have often created long delays in him putting out episodes.
Right.
And it's my theory that it you got to have a good story, and you got to be able to put things out in audio so it's engaging and people listen to it and are entertained and there's no technical hiccups, et cetera, but you got to be there every week.
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to watch my numbers, and I've had a couple incidents in the past year where, you know, I've taken a month or two off, and I have watched the numbers absolutely plummet. It's comical. It's people are only as loyal as you are prolific and as willing as you are to sacrifice yourself to be there week in and week out.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can see, MERS numbers are arguably the same as Hutch and I's. I mean, depending on what kind of metrics you're looking at, she's got a really big audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because she's been doing this nonstop. She's got, like, I don't know, what, fourth or fifth book she's on now in her short stories, and I should be writing and all the blogging. You know, she's wound up in a situation where she can really put a lot of time and consistent weekly effort into getting her stuff out. And that's mm-hmm. really what makes the difference. So the reason Hutch and I have the bigger rocket ship is because we've been flying the rocket ship longer and straighter than anybody else.
Okay.
You know, Hutch is watching his numbers go right in the crapper right now because he's not putting out consistent new content.
Mm-hmm.
mine are taking a little bit of a hit because I'm right now primarily putting out Contagious, which a lot of people have already gone and bought and read and don't necessarily need to listen to. But they're kind of treading water, my numbers. And if I'm able to put new stuff out on a weekly basis, after about 6 months, those numbers would start to go up again. So that's a very long answer. It's my theory. I really believe there's so many people on the internet. No matter what you put out, you're going to find people who like your stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've been following this whole Stephen King, Stephanie Myers feud that popped up the past couple of days, but you know, Stephen King is saying Stephanie Myers is very popular and she's a good storyteller, but she's just flat out a bad writer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from the nuts and bolts perspective, you know, he's right. I mean, if you were to submit most Stephanie Myers stuff into a high school senior English class, it would not be graded very well. It's just not written very well.
Right.
But there's so many people out there that the content and the storytelling that she's giving are appealing to them. And the reason I make that example is you just don't know who's going to gravitate towards your stuff. As long as it's out there and you're delivering it consistently, you will find an audience for your content. So that's the way you get the rocket ship, is plan a 3 to 5 year arc for this. And that's a really big bit to chew off. But if you go back and listen to the interviews I did with Hutch and T 2 years ago, that was my theory back then. I'm like, it's going to take 3 to 5 years of doing this consistently before someone breaks into the New York Times bestseller list.
And lo and behold, it's been about 3 years.
That's right about 3.5 years. I snuck in there. So, and I think Hutch has a real good shot of getting in there in 2009 as well.
Okay, let me ask you this then, for just personal interest. Do you think there's anything in epic fantasy that keeps it from making the mark that you and Hutch have? You know, you guys do kind of real world, you know, as I said, visceral sort of, you know, you've got the violence and the language, and that's, you know, that's not always a big selling point, because I look at movies like PG movies are always grossing higher than R-rated movies, at least that, you know, that's the numbers that they quote are bigger. So can epic fantasy draw those same numbers, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You're seeing epic fantasy regularly on the New York Times, you know, the New York Times bestseller list.
Right, right.
It's it's out there and you can get it. Hutch and I have a little bit. Hutch has a decent advantage because he's got so much computer techie stuff in his fiction.
Right.
And a lot of the people listening to podcasts really know computers, and they hear that and it just appeals to their personal interests. My stuff not so much in the computer techie side, but I got a lot of scientific stuff in there, and that's a similar group. But I really think it's just that most of the epic fantasy that's been out in podcast form, you haven't had the same thing. You haven't had consistent delivery of epic fantasy week in and week out for 3 years. Okay. People write their one book, then they take a 6 or 7 to 8 month break, then they come back with another book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the numbers start to drop down, and you have to work just to build them back up to where you were. But epic fantasy regularly is hitting the New York Times bestseller list now.
Oh, yeah.
Regularly.
Yeah.
Hardcover fiction, paperback fiction. It's the same audience listening to our podcast that are out buying books. I don't think there's really any difference there.
Yeah.
It's waiting for someone to do it long enough to go out and get it. Because most of the epic fantasy people are geeks, you know?
Yeah.
Like most of my fans are geeks. So
right.
Somebody's going to do it. It's just a matter of who and when.
Good point. And I will take those marching orders and run with them. you touched on something when you were talking about the quality of writing was number one, good content. And that's one of the things I tried to make the case in my blog post, was that you, above all, are a good writer. You take your responsibility as a storyteller seriously, and you write really well. So I think that, you know, the number one, if you're not a good writer, it's probably going to show.
Yes.
And that's something that I tried to make clear, I guess, is that there's no gimmick. You know, it helps that you're a Tyler's promoter. It helps that you get on other shows and you do this sort of this viral marketing thing. But if you weren't a good writer, you wouldn't get anywhere with it.
Well, that's true. And I mean, like, literally there is like my home life and family. And then the second priority in my life is busting my ass on these stories so that they're as good as I can make them.
Mm-hmm.
for the people who take the valuable time out of their life to listen. But you know, that goes back to the whole Stephanie Meyer's angle. There's a lot of haters out there of her because she's a bad writer. She's terrible at the technical side of things. Again, the point of that is you got to make your stories as solid as you can make them, and you cannot phone in story or performance, but good is a relative term. And you can go into a bookstore and you can go to the hardcover table with all the stuff that the publishers are promoting heavily. Mm-hmm. And if you were to flip the first 20 pages of all those, probably half of them, you'd go, this is crap. Yeah. How did this even get published? You know, like, that's the question if you're an aspiring writer. That's what you're always shrugging your shoulders up into your ears and wide-eyed screaming to the hills. How did this get published? Yeah. This is awful. And yet it'll go out and sell thousands. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read a Danielle Steele novel, but dude, I can't even get through 50 pages of one of those. That girl has sold somewhere in the range of 600 million copies of her books. It's insane. So it's not that you have to be good according to some predetermined benchmark. You have to make the stories the best you can make them. And if you can make them better, you need to do that while keeping in mind your job is to put out product, multiple products, so that people can consume you and you can entertain them. And you don't spend 10 years making your great novel. But it's really about, it's like you got to put stuff out. And, you know, you finish a book, you move on. You finish a book, you move on. But again, this is the internet age. There's a billion people online. If you promote your stuff and deliver consistently, the audience is going to find you. Mm-hmm. And I may think your stuff is garbage, but the guy in the cubicle next to me may say it's the greatest thing he's ever read.
Right. So that, as they say in the biz, is that. I want people to understand that when I said oops, I was talking about myself, because this novel that I'm going to be putting out in podcast form, the idea first started germinating in 1997. So I've been working on it for a while. It's gone through many permutations and changes and restarts and false starts and redos and rewrites, but it's a far cry from where it started. And the novel that the series I hope to be starting after this one, that idea started around the same time. It germinated around the same time. That was the first half. Next Saturday we'll get the second half. So thanks for listening, and there'll be oodles and oodles of good stuff to come in the second half. So we will see you next week. Here's Dr. John Smarr.
You've been listening to The Adventures of Indiana Jim, a production of Visionary Creative Works. Visit podcast.indianajim.net and leave comments on the blog. Send in your emails and audio feedback to podcast@indianajim.net. I'm Dr. John Smarr. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.